Men on Board, Episode 6. Today, the category is Area Control. We're going to be talking about Kemet and Scythe. Then we're going to have a broad review discussion where we define the terms Eurogame and Ameritrash. Hello, and thank you for downloading Men on Board. I am Aaron.
Hey guys, I'm Josh.
I'm Jameson.
And Matt is not here.
Matt had to go back east for a little while. There were some family-related issues, so he's going to be with his family back east for a little while. But we miss him very much, and as soon as we find out more about the computer program Skype, which is this new technology, we will have him back.
We are not good at this game yet, but we will press on without him.
He's not going to be here for this episode. He's with us in spirit, and also he's not going to be with us next episode either.
Because behind the curtains, we film these episodes back-to-back. But yeah, everything's okay with Matt. He's just taking some time, and we hope to have him back here soon.
Yeah, whatever.
We love him very much, and we miss him dearly.
And on the subject of programming notes, we have Jameson for this episode, and I'm pretty sure we'll have him for next episode too. But Jameson is about to have some big life changes too.
Mm-hmm. There is a baby coming. He probably won't be born today, but I have my phone here just in case, and it'll be kind of hard to record for a couple weeks, but I'm not planning on letting it completely change. It's going to change every aspect of my life, but not the parts I like.
So said
every expectant father ever. Yeah.
It'll be different for me.
Yeah, of course.
The other 100 billion children that have been born, those are just aberrations.
So we're hoping to record these episodes a little bit spaced out so there's not a big interruption to our format, but bear with us as we're going through this transitionary period.
We're still in our childhood phase of podcasting.
Yeah. Well, also, we want to make sure that we're doing these and we don't lose our buffer for Christmas, because there's always stuff that comes up, even if we don't think there will be. So we're just making sure that we can keep the stream going, even if the quality falls apart for a little while. So you guys can just bear with us.
My quality's top notch.
Yeah, because what we've discovered is that we love doing this.
We do.
You guys like us doing this, so we're going to keep doing it. Today, we're talking about area control. So, Josh, what is area control?
Oh, I get the big question. Not just, I thought you were going to tell me, you know, what game we're talking about, but that's fine. Let's talk about area control. I mean, I think area control is, it can take a number of different forms. Usually revolves upon some sort of strength or territory holding that results in a benefit for the person who holds it. Oftentimes associated with war or combat, or outmaneuvering your opponent to get advantage of territories that are either more lucrative, yield you points for fighting, or position your troops or your units or some aspect of your future gameplay in such a way that you will lead yourself to victory, I would imagine.
You know what? I'm just going to throw this out there. Is Catan an area control game?
Ooh.
Like, it's not directly violence-based, but it is something that a whole lot of people are going to be familiar with.
You are literally talking to someone who's played Catan one time in his entire life. That is how bad it is. Ironic that I'm doing this podcast in how much I don't like Catan and how little I've played it.
So I would say my personal definition of area control is that part of it has to be that the area can be taken away from you. And in Catan, you're not really getting the area taken away.
That's a great point.
I think that's part of what an area control game is that you take it, but you might not have it the entire game. And part of the mechanics of the game enables someone else to come in and take it from you.
Is that maybe why you disagree with Board Game Geek regarding their categorization of Five Tribes?
Absolutely. Well, and that's, you control an area by like claiming an area, but...
And it can never be taken from you,
exactly.
Which is stupid.
Exactly.
Well, we like Five Tribes, just not as many control.
We do.
So our first game we're going to be talking about today is Kemet. Josh, tell us a little bit about Kemet.
Cool. So Kemet is my game. Kemet is a game that takes place in a mythical version of ancient Egypt in which each player is a god. And as that god, they control a number of troops that go out in order to conquest temples, slaughter other opposing gods' troops, or raise their pyramids up to a victorious level. The Kemet board is basically a map of Egypt. It's a really clever map. It's double-sided, and it plays for different number of players on each side. The spaces represent either deserts, your own city, a temple, or a possible sanctuary to the gods. And basically, they're all areas that you want to control, specifically the temples, in order to earn yourself victory points. Now, victory points in this game are unique in that some of them are temporary victory points and some of them are permanent victory points. And the game styles itself as a sort of very aggressive race-focused game, because the first place person to win and hold on to 8 or 10 or however many victory points you choose to play to at the end of a round wins the game. A big component of the game is determining which order players go into, and that's determined by the player in last place. But each round of the game is divided into a night phase and a day phase. Night is basically just a recharge phase where you get more onks, which are prayer points. They're basically the currency of the game. And then you resolve any powers that you've bought. But more importantly, during the day phase is really where the players take all their actions. The game plays 2 to 5 players, and everyone has an identical set of actions with 5 action markers to take. And actions are things like moving your troops, recruiting new troops, buying an associated power tile, raising one of your city's pyramids up to a level, or just praying for more currency in order to do more things. So things in the game cost money and require you to power up things to do something. The other unique thing about the game is combat. It's a very combat-focused game because one of the only ways to win a permanent victory point is to fight and be victorious as the attacker. Every player starts with an identical hand of 6 combat cards, and each time you fight, you determine your strength based on the units on the field. You get to pick a combat card, basically representing your battle tactics or formations that you're putting forward, and then you resolve those, and you discard one card at random, so you're never quite sure which cards your opponents still have in their hand. What that means is that every 3 turns, you get your entire hand of combat cards back into your hand. So at the end of the game, points come from holding temples, and if you control 2 temples at the end of a round, you can get a permanent victory point, winning battles, raising your pyramids, or just buying power tiles that are worth victory points. And that's basically a rundown of Kemet.
Josh, who is the designer of Kemet?
So Kemet is a game that was published in 2012. It is a Madagot title. The designer is Jacques Berriot and Guillaume Montiage. I think it's Montiage. Art by Dimitri Bialak. Let's go with Bialak. And Emile Denis and Nicolas Fructus. Ooh, that's a good name. And Madagot, I believe, is an Asmodee publisher now. So Asmodee Madagot.
I think it's Madagot.
Yeah, let's go. Madago. That's what I know about Kemet.
Actually, do not ever trust me on the pronunciation of anything.
Yeah, I wasn't going to say anything, but...
Is Madago a French company, Madago? It should be Madago if it's French.
I honestly don't know where they're from. I just think I've heard it as Madago.
Oh, it's fine. Let's go with that.
This is an interesting game. This is a very player interactive game. You have to constantly be going after your neighbor in order to win this game. And if you're not comfortable doing that, you should not play this game.
I will certainly say this is not a game that everyone will enjoy. There is no doubt that this is a game that some people will absolutely dislike playing. It is an aggressive game. It encourages you to attack people when they're at the most vulnerable and when it is the best benefit to you to do so.
Yeah, it's pretty adversarial, and it's also adversarial in a way that even though some area control games do allow for like a level of diplomacy, there really isn't that here. It's much more about just jumping on your opponents when they're at their weakest and also trying to like, I feel like there's a lot of posturing, but not much negotiation. Whereas if you take a different area control game, there might be much more of like trying to, you know, coalition build a little bit. This is much more about just striking while the iron is hot and getting things before, you know, getting yours while you still can.
Yeah, you definitely do not have any allies in this game. Every single person sitting around the table is your enemy, and they will slit your throat if they can do it.
That is true. Reading a lot of the comments of this game, there are people that really love this game, and there is like people that have compiled strategy guides on just exactly the way to play this game. And I can imagine that because the power tiles are the same every time. What's not the same is what your opponents end up racing for. And a lot of those first early turns really depend on which tiles you want to get. And that can determine your gameplay a lot.
I think that would lead into my first real criticism of this game. So it's super deep, which is a good thing. But because there's one of each tile. So one player can have each tile. So there's real races for some that are more efficient. There's engine building tiles. There's ones that can increase your number of actions. Those are really precious. There's ones that can help you level up your pyramids faster. And each one of the trees seems like it has a couple of ones that if you want to get into that tree at all during the game, you need to get a couple of tiles there really quickly. At the same time, the tiles are hard to read. There are essentially no player aids, at least there's very little
there's
in the way
one,
of player
yeah.
aids. Josh had printed out a couple of copies of stuff, so we were at least sort of able to look at what the tiles meant without having to all pass it around and really telegraph what we were doing. But the issue is that it's kind of dense. It's sort of hard to figure out what your priorities should be. And at the same time, there's such a big risk reward for making the right decision at the right time. If you think like an RTS almost, like StarCraft, you have to have a build order to a degree that is maybe not enjoyable for everyone.
There are definitely synergies in the tiles. I don't know if there's an optimal route. I've read that it's very possible to go either way. What determines a lot of that initial play, though, is that you set the levels of your pyramids at the beginning of the game, which determine which tiles you're able to purchase. So if you're playing a 4-player game and 2 players have gone for the same sort of color pyramid. You don't have to spend all your points, but you get 3 points to spend to distribute amongst your pyramid. So it's very common that you might see someone start with a level 3 pyramid and they instantly have access to one of those level 3 power tiles.
And what Josh is talking about with these pyramids is that each player has potentially 3 pyramids.
They're D4s.
Yeah, they're D4s, and they're actually a really, really cool mechanic.
Yeah, they are.
Because those pyramids, what level you have them at, determines which tiles that you can buy. Like the red tiles that are controlled by the red pyramid are all offensive powers, blue tiles are defensive, and white are utility. And they're all in levels. There's levels 1, 2, 3, and 4 powers. So your pyramid has to be at that level in order to buy that power. So when you're starting off the game and you're trying to figure out where to start your initial pyramid levels, there's a lot of thought into thinking, what are my combos going to be? What's my strategy here?
And respond to something Josh said, it's not that there's one way that's best. The issue is that there are a lot of suboptimal ways. There might be 3 or 4 really good paths that go down completely different routes. But if you don't identify that you're the person right in front of you in the order is going for a path and you don't change your pace quickly enough, you might be in a situation where you're constantly just going for second best.
And that's certainly true. And I would say that in a lot of games, I always preface this game when I teach it to tell people that it's not a slow build game. Because a lot of games like this, you're used to sort of turtling and taking your time. And I find that if you do that, you are a turn or two behind everyone else. Because if someone whips out there early, claims 2 temples while you're back at your home base rallying a force or building up some power tiles, it's not that you can't rush out and win later on. I mean, there are turns in this game where you can get 5 and 6 points in a turn, I've heard of. I find it hard to believe on some people even claim that they've gotten like 7 points in a turn. I don't know about that. But you can definitely, with a well-planned turn, execute some pretty pivotal moves. But if you start off slow and you aren't sort of building and fighting the entire time, you can find yourself trailing behind, especially if you're a new player in this game.
There is one thing I don't want to go off the wrong impression about. This is not a game where you have to plan way down the line. And I think this is kind of what you're talking about with hurdling, too. This is a game where I feel like a lot of the incentive or a lot of the strength is in recognizing the most optimal choice that you have in front of you at that moment and realizing that the step after that might be just completely different by the time it's your turn again. So a lot of it is recognizing, okay, what can I do here that's really productive? How can I get an edge over everybody else? And then also, I mean, you kind of want to cloak what you're doing there. You're definitely not, there's a level of manipulation there that is about more than just memorizing the best path forward. It seems much more, it's much less picking a path that you need to do and like, then I do this, then I do this, and then step 3 is this. And much more of, if you are going for this strategy, there are going to be a couple of really important things that can help you get there.
One of the things I really like about this game, because I'm a child, is that it has really nice toys. Part of the upgrades that you can buy or can be these different little figures that each have their own little individual creatures powers. But they're awesome. They're like a giant scorpion and like a giant mummy and like a sphinx.
Mm-hmm. A phoenix. And a stupid snake that ruins all the other creatures. Ruins them. It's a life-ruining snake.
Was my giant scorpion, was that the thing that I kept on tormenting people with?
It's not your scorpion. I bought the scorpion in the last game. Thank you very much. I'd like you to quit referring to it as your scorpion.
I really, really like the combat system in this game.
Oh, it's very clever.
Yeah, because everyone has a hand of 6 cards. And that mechanic of you have to play a card, and then so everyone sees what that card is, and then you're secretly discarding a card. You're playing kind of like a game with yourself where you're trying to remember what people had to know that what card you can get away with playing so that you can hold back a card for later. And I love
that. Still never certain. I'm amazed at the levels of different outcomes that can happen just based on a single card, because one of the factors of a card is there are little blood drops on them and those kill your units. So you can have a very strong attack, but it leaves you really vulnerable and you don't have any shields. So if you have a weak army doing a really strong attack and someone comes in and plays a bunch of blood on you, you might not have anyone left to claim that territory at the end of your battle. And then it's made the whole entire battle worthless for you. It's a very interesting system. I really do enjoy it. There's even a couple cards you can buy to exchange with your cards. You have a slightly different hand, but there's 1-4 combat card in everyone's hand, and it's trying to be like, have you played your 4 yet? Or you've played? No, you haven't played yours, but yeah, there's some card counting in there too that's really neat. I mean, I like cards, so I think that's great.
And what Josh is talking about with the blood is a nice little mechanic in there too, is that no one's, even if you lose a battle, you're not losing figures on the board necessarily. However, each card or some of the creatures or some of these little bonus divine intervention cards have this little blood symbol on them. And you, at the end of a combat, you'll look at, how much the attacker's blood versus or one player's blood versus the other player's shield. And both sides are looking at this. And for every blood that doesn't have a shield, they're losing a figure, which I thought was really, really interesting for a combat game, is that you're not necessarily losing anybody. And then you have the option of just moving those people that weren't killed just to the next adjacent spot.
That option is really interesting. So at the end of a combat, you have a choice if you're the loser and if you're the winner of whether you want to hold on to the territory. If you're the loser, you can choose to retreat, which is the winner positions you in an adjacent tile somewhere, or you can recall all your troops back to your divinity land and you get the currency of the game. You get prayer points for every troop that you recall that way. And the winner can also do this, which is very clever because maybe you've just fought a battle and you won, but you've left yourself in a really weak state. You might not want to stay in that territory to let some other player coming after you just pick you off. It may be more advantageous to you to get the heck out of there and then come back on the board at a different turn when you're at your full strength. It's very neat.
Yeah, and this is definitely a game that rewards repeated plays.
Yes.
Because there are a ton of tiles, a ton of these divine intervention cards, all kinds of different strategies. And even on your first play, the strategy, it isn't extremely clear. Like, you don't really get just how combative this game is and just what you should go after when. So this is one of those games that you really should play a couple times to really get a good feel for it.
Yeah, I would even write off your first play or two of it as just a learning experience, because figuring out how the areas on the board work, because there's sort of a delta at the top of the board that seems useless, except when you realize how many prayer points you can get there. It's also a temple that doesn't let you come back from it. So it's sort of a land of no return for your troops if you're up there.
When you were explaining the game to us, when you were sort of setting up, I got the impression that it was extremely valuable. Like, I think it does come across as being valuable. The thing is that it can only really be valuable to one person. It's kind of there are some other games we'll talk about like this, but it has the potential to become just a giant tar pit where everybody's just hurling troops into it and wasting stuff and nobody's getting anything. And then potentially people would be collecting stuff on the fringes. So in the game that I played with Josh, one player kind of had control of it throughout most of the game. And every now and then somebody would go, make things a little bit harder for him. But the reason for that was that it would not be advantageous for us to fight him off unless we were then convinced that we could do the same thing that he was doing and just sit on it and get value from it.
Right. And the thing that makes it tempting too is that at that temple, you have to sacrifice a unit every time to get the prayer points back. So that force there is always getting weaker and weaker, and it makes it more and more of a tempting target. What you guys didn't play with, when you play with an odd number of players, there's an additional space at the top of the board called the Sanctuary of All Gods. It's not a temple, but what's unique about that is that you can send troops there and actually just get a victory point by sacrificing two troops just from being there. It's another land of no return, but it's a highly contested area just because just being there, you can win a fight and you can just get victory points there. It's a really neat spot on that. Another thing I was going to say real quick is the map is interesting. The map looks like everything's far away, but it's not. Everything is literally next to you because you have the ability to teleport from one of your pyramids to any of the obelisks that are spread pretty much uniformly throughout the map. So it can seem like there can be a player on the other side of the map, and then they're instantly outside of your walls or in the same temple that you were because nothing's out of reach, which I think is really clever and keeps the game fast moving and very interactive.
Yeah, and I think that's one thing that they kept consistent throughout the entire design is that everything is very tight. Like, this is a game that you win at 8 points or 10 if you're playing the longer version. Yeah. And in these combats, you're limited to how many people you can put on a certain space. I think it's five figures per space, and your cards are only giving you another 4 bonus. Maybe a monster will give you a 2 bonus, and maybe a couple cards could get you 1 or 2 more points. But each fight, you're have like a max total points of 12, maybe 14,
something like
if
that,
you spend a ton of cards. So everything's always just very, very close, and you never really feel completely out of it, which is something I really, really enjoy about this game.
Yeah, that's true. I do think a player can come back or at least keep down a player that's in the lead. And I think players almost have to do that. I think that's part of the problem with playing with players of different skill level. And that is a criticism I have of the game, is that it's hard to tell players what to do. It is easy to king make, and it is tricky to have a game where someone knows the game more than the other players and try and encourage the other players, like, if you don't do this, this player is going to win. You have to, I know you're not comfortable doing this because you feel like you're weak right now, but if you don't continuously harass that player or harry him a bit, he's just going to run away with it, or she. for that matter. Sorry.
Yay, inclusiveness.
That's something that I think is just going to be the case with a lot of relatively deep, relatively high-skill level games. I think there is a ceiling to this game, but as far as board games go, this is still being familiar with it, being experienced with it is going to be a huge advantage. And the upside of that is that it actually is rewarding to play multiple times. The downside is that if you have a person of much lower skill level, they are probably going to get walked all over. Whereas, you know, some games just have a much, maybe risk has a higher factor of it, or maybe it's just a flatter build, and there aren't so many suboptimal paths, and so you're in a situation where the distance between the first player and the last seems a lot smaller. Mm-hmm. This is not one of those games.
Yeah, this is, if kingmaking bothers you, this is not a game I'd recommend. I am a person that can make a game not as fun for other people because I really don't like kingmaking. I played this last night and really embarrassed myself, but luckily I have great friends that don't hold that against me. But if that is something that you don't particularly enjoy, maybe steer clear from this one.
So the game I played, which I'd actually had two players in common with the one you did, it didn't really feel like that to me. Like, I honestly don't think that kingmaking really came up at all. It was so adversarial, but also, like, pretty even-keeled. I felt like one player had a little bit of agency in terms of, you know, who he could... There were certainly decisions about, like, okay, who is getting too big for their britches? Who do I need to throw an elbow at? But it wasn't like, who am I going to help win? It was much more like, who do I need to friggin' throw to the wolves?
The games that I played in both these games that they're talking about, played out very, very differently. And I don't know if that's just this. I mean, one game was much faster than the other ones, and that can happen in this game. This is a game that can be over in four turns, four to five turns, turn being a day and a night cycle. But they can go by very, very quickly. I think one of the big things that can make or break this game is setting the turn order is very important. And the losing player, or the player currently with the least victory points, gets to determine the turn order for everyone for the next day. That's incredibly powerful. It's so powerful that you could actually even wait back a turn before scoring any victory points, just so you have that power for a turn or two to set yourself up. Because going last, I don't think there's any way to deny that going last is an advantage in this game.
Oh, absolutely.
So I want to also bring this up too, because it's one of the most common criticisms of this game. There is an expansion of this game, and in that they changed the victory condition to that the minute you have 8 points, you have to last until the start of your next turn. So you play a whole other round. I think that would add way too much time on the game, because then it just turns into everyone stopping you.
Dogpiling whoever's in the front.
That's what I would think. People seem to like it. People seem to say that they fixed this problem. Huh. I didn't think it was a problem. I just thought it was something to be aware of, that going last is very powerful. So if you're not going to go last, you need to set yourself up really early in the turn order. But that is one of the things the expansion fixes. And it is something that players have said they can just change without buying the expansion as well. So.
Yeah, I was kind of thinking of it as a feature, not a bug. Mm-hmm. I kind of like games like that where holding yourself back, you know, there are some advantages to disadvantages to having fewer victory points. I mean, it's not like being in the last place is unambiguously positive. I like the idea that that being in last place is an advantage, that you might want to be in a situation where you are the underdog for mechanical reasons. So I didn't really have a problem with that.
I didn't either. Like I said, it's just the most common criticism of the game is people saying if you're last, that's, you know, you have the power to win instantly. And I can see that.
One last thing about Kemet, which is not the case about the next game we're going to talk about, is that I mentioned earlier that just the player aids, the lack of player aids, the symbology was kind of confusing. A lot of this stuff is really dense. Sometimes it's different to tell between the difference between like a silver figure and a gold figure. It's hard to tell what some of the symbols are. I like that it's meant to be hieroglyphics and it's meant to be evocative of that. But I felt like it was a little too obscure sometimes. And also just the levels of color, the levels of saturation just made it hard to see what was on the tiles a lot of the time.
That's fair.
Yeah. Oh, and Matt made me promise that I would talk about colorblindness. Colorblind issues for this. Basically, the colors are pretty much limited to your different player pieces, and they all have different sculpts. So even if colors are similar, they are very thematically sculpted. Like the snake goddess has snake-shaped people.
Yeah, and the cat one has little claws on there. Yeah.
So you're going to be able to tell your people apart. So.
I don't know if I noticed that.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's awesome.
It also, it does play with two. It is one of the few war games. It's not ideal, in my opinion, with two, but you can play it. There's a separate map, and you only play half the map, essentially, with two players. So it still retains the tightness with just two.
Awesome. Our next game is going to be Scythe. And Scythe was published in 2016 by Stonemaier Games, designed by Jamie Stegmaier, and art by Jacob Rosalski. In Scythe, you have a lot going on. So this overview is going to be very, very broad and not so much into the details because there's a lot of them. But the game is set in 1920s Europa in an alternate past, immediately after a great war and featuring armored mechs. Players are each a different faction that are competing to be the wealthiest at the end of the game. The board is a map of Europa that is divided into hexes, and each faction has a designated start area along the outside of the board. At the center of the board is the factory area. Players also start with a leader figure, along with worker meeples. Players each have their own unique player mats that show the actions available to a player on their turn. The mat is divided into four columns and two rows, and on a player's turn, they are able to select a column and then complete the top row and bottom row action in that column so long as they meet the action's requirements. Actions allow players to do a lot of different things. You can move your workers or mech, bolster your power, gain some combat cards, produce resources, upgrade actions, deploy mechs, along with various other things. Players are able to gain additional action possibilities by controlling that central factory space on the board, where you can get factory cards that unlock new abilities. Combat occurs when one player moves their leader and or one of their mechs into a space controlled by another player's leader or mech. Players will secretly select an amount of power to use during the combat and can bolster this amount with combat cards. The player that reveals the highest sum is the winner and will send their opponents back to their starting area. The game ends whenever a player has placed their sixth star on the board by accomplishing certain goals, such as completing all their upgrades, deploying all their mechs, winning combats, maximizing your popularity or power. And then at the end of the game, money is awarded to each player for the amount of territories and resources they control, as well as the number of stars they have placed on the board. The amount of money for each category is dependent on how much popularity that player has gained throughout the game. The winner is whichever player has accumulated the most wealth.
That is a very broad overview for a game that I feel like doesn't even touch on what the core of Scythe is. Like, it's saying a lot of things, but it really... it feels very abstract compared to the game itself.
So I write these outlines ahead of whenever we record, and I was trying to condense everything as small as possible. Really, if you just listen to this discussion, and if you haven't played Scythe, I would say just go out and play it. Spoiler alerts, I love this game, but definitely check out a video, read up on it to try to get a better idea of everything that's going on in this game.
Let me start by, one of the central mechanics is also one of the things that I like most about it, and that is stuff is happening all the time. The player turns overlap to a certain extent, and maybe Josh... Yeah, Josh, say that again a little bit louder.
That's my favorite part. I love that if someone is finishing their action, the next player can already be doing their action. It can move so quickly and you can get so much done in such a small period of time because it doesn't lag a lot.
It's probably my single favorite part about this game. I have played this game a lot, usually with you guys. I don't think I've ever come above second to last. I have had a blast every time because I'm constantly doing stuff.
Yeah.
Now, what are some of those options, Josh?
What options? The things you can do? You just want to win in this game.
What are the actual little actions you can do?
Oh, the actions you can do? So Every player's mat is separated into four actions. And what's unique is that you have a faction mat and a...
Player mat
and faction mat. Essentially, they make an asymmetrical setup for you every time. So the actions are always the same, but they're not paired with the same bottom row actions. So sometimes you do your... civilization is at odds with the sort of resources that you start on. Sometimes you have a really great synergy going right from the get-go. And it's really analyzing those weaknesses and those strengths that can lead to a good play. This is another game that definitely rewards multiple plays. It is, your first play is going to be fine, but the more and more you play, new things will begin to appear on the board. To the point that I find when I'm playing now, it's just an efficiency game. It's just the most efficient way you can do any little thing gets you the edge on your opponent.
Yeah, because every single faction is starting with two different hexes. And then
three different
hexes. And your starting resources are going to be controlled by those hexes. And everyone's player mat, their bottom row actions are the ones that require resources to do. And each one of those actions will require different resources for different players. And then as you're going around and upgrading your player mats to make your actions more efficient, which is done in such an amazing way.
Yeah, the upgrade action is cool.
It's so, and I'm saying like three different things at the same time, and it's because I really, really love this game. So I apologize for that. But really fast with the upgrades, you get this board, and on the top row actions, there are a bunch of little wooden cubes. And for your upgrade action, you move that wooden cube down from the top row action into the bottom row action, into a nice little recessed area, because it all just fits and works so well. But in that process, you're, by removing the cube, you're unlocking something additional that the top row action will do, and then covering up a requirement to do a bottom row action. It is so well thought out. It is so much fun. There are so many different things you can do in this game, and it's amazing.
So normally this is something I don't like in games like this. There is a huge reward to planning your stuff out ahead of time. You need to make that assessment pretty early based on the hand that you're dealt, like based on the player mat that you have and the faction that you have and your position on the table. But it really does reward a lot of planning, and you kind of need to have a strategy. This is less of an issue for me in this game than it is for a lot of others, because you can do your turns at the same time, because you're not constantly waiting on other people, and because there's just a lot more momentum, I feel. So this is of the games where I feel like I'm strongly incentivized to plan way ahead. This is probably the least disruptive of those for me for that reason.
Well, and I think part of that is a little bit what I was talking about earlier with the efficiency mechanism. When I play this game, I'm planning, but I'm also tactically responding to my current situation. I'm always looking at my board being like, I can do that action now, but is that the best time to do it? Or do I wait a turn when I have a little bit more wood and I can really do a building? And that way, I don't want to take an action if I can't do both parts of the action. That's just a wasted turn. So maybe I trade now and I get something, and then I can do something else in the future. It's those kinds of planning that I think reward good, careful play. And that's one of the things I enjoy about this game. It can feel very subtle, though. It's hard to teach. I find it hard to teach that to people when I'm teaching the game the first time, is to try and explain just how critical each little detail of the thing can turn out to be.
The components in this game are absolutely
amazing. Oh, they're beautiful. Beautiful.
You have all these little wooden meeples that are your workers, and each faction, the cut of their meeple and the shape of their meeple is different.
Very cute.
So not only are they different colors, but they're also different cuts, which really, really helps with color blindness. And you have your buildings as well as little plastic mechs. All your mechs are actually made of plastic, but they're still of a similar quality. Sometimes that mixture of different materials can be a little bit jarring and doesn't seem as cohesive a design. But in this game, even though they're plastic and wood, they work so well together.
So you guys both went crazy in on the Kickstarter, if I remember correctly. What does the normal version of this game come with?
So I actually have the normal version.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
And Josh has the Kickstarter version. And every time I look at my version, I just wish I would have done the Kickstarter.
There are no Kickstarter exclusives in this game, though. They are all available out there. And I mean, so the art in this game is really neat, too. I think Jacob, who is the artist, did a phenomenal job, because he really got this impressionistic, neoclassical almost look that gives a very real world feel to the world that he created. And it is not a game that I think is very story heavy. You could evoke a story when you're doing it. I don't find it's a super story heavy game.
What are there is actually a couple
encounter
really
cards?
Like the things from Dead of Winter, but yeah, for whatever reason, way more organic and way better executed.
The encounter cards is one of my few criticisms of this game.
Oh,
and
really?
I know it was done intentionally that they were left blank. Yeah, but I don't feel like I ever see them or care about them. They are purely, to me, a way to get resources or do something more efficient. I look at the art and I really appreciate it, but I want there to be more of a story or a title to that card going on. Because when someone else gets an encounter card, I am never looking at their encounter thing.
I thought they did have titles.
No.
Yeah, I thought they were all like, no. You find a picnic in
the
woods.
They have choices that you can do. But there's no you walk in a field and do this thing. It's just like, pay the farmer this. Do this.
I completely disagree. I think I look at that art and then I see what my choices are, and I feel like I know the story. I feel like the art is done in such a way, and the choices, the way that they're presented, I know exactly what's going on here.
Yeah, I'm with Aaron on this.
But you never make a choice based on what you want to happen. You make a choice based on what's the best resource for you to get. Like, you're just, I'm going to do that because I need popularity, because popularity is critical in this game.
Yeah, but you're doing that as the leader of a sovereign nation in this little hellhole of the world.
Yeah.
This is a tough world, Josh.
You're motivated by your desire to make your people like you while you crush them into making munitions for your mechs or whatever.
My point being that I never have a strong sense of player interaction in those moments, because I don't look at anyone else's cards when they come out. I just assume that they're doing their own thing.
Yeah, that's true. This is one of the less in terms of that, because usually with games and theme,
I want
the story.
Yeah.
And I can definitely see the story, but I have never made a choice in this game based on my character's story.
It's not once.
Purely, this is going to help me the most in this moment.
Let's talk about playing a little bit more. So the map on this board is unique because each player starts on sort of a peninsula, and each player has a unique power associated with their faction, and they're all very, very different powers, and they lend a critically different feel to how you approach and play each one of this game. For example, one of the limitations of this game is that you can't repeat the actions on your player mat twice in a row. Well, one of the factions breaks that rule. I think it's the Russian faction, or the Rusviet faction, I should say, that lets you just spam actions over and over again with no consequence. Now, that seems really powerful until maybe you've done that so many times that you actually neglected everything else and you've overspent, or you've sort of focused too much on one thing. You know, another, the action gives you sort of a very variable mode. It's Crimea, where you can spend a combat card as any resource that's wild. The blue people, your villagers can swim because no other player is able to cross rivers until you get mechs. So every player that starts is limited to their peninsula, except for the little Vikings, and they're Nords. but they just swim. They just spread out and conquer territory and stuff. The powers are really unique and lend a different feel every time you play this game. And that's one of my favorite things about it.
And every time I feel like, oh, this is my favorite faction, and I'll try to, like, and if I get to play that faction two times in a row, I'm like, oh, this is absolutely my favorite faction. And then the next time I play the game, I usually get a different one, and then all of a sudden, that's my favorite faction.
Yeah.
Because I went through a long period with the faction that got to pick the two options on the encounter cards,
Polonia.
And that was absolutely my favorite. But lately, that yellow power with being able to use the combat cards as resources is amazing. I will say, I have never won this game. I have played this game so many times. It is absolutely my favorite game that came out last year. I never win. I very rarely come even close to winning, but I will still play it all the time.
It is also a weird game in that I often/almost always win this game, and often don't know why. I know that I'm doing, I mean, I know what I'm doing, but I still feel like I don't know why I'm so ahead of everyone else or winning so often when I play the game.
You just have this great subconscious ability to calculate everything out and
maybe
end the game at the right moment.
Yeah, that I do definitely end, like, I think players let me get too much territory.
Yeah.
I often end up being like, oh, I have a lot of territory. I'm going to end this game right now because I can.
So maybe they don't quite control the board as much as...
Hey.
And that's why, because this game
maybe the territory is...
that's because everyone's afraid of losing...
It's kind of a central part of it.
Well, I mean, people are afraid to lose popularity because when you scare their workers off, you lose popularity. And popularity gets you into the final scoring bracket at the end of this game, and it's very important. So no one, if you leave like a little wall of workers out there, no one really wants to mess with your workers. I mean, they will, but it's usually to their detriment for a while. Maybe that's why they let me win. I don't know.
No one has ever let you win. I constantly win all the time in this game. And I think that kind of, because Scythe is a game that has a lot more outside of the area control than Kemet does. There's a lot more things you can do with getting your engine going in Scythe, and your engine, I think, is a little bit more important in Scythe than it is in Kemet.
Certainly.
But at its core, I really think that Scythe is an area control game because, like you said, you win all the time because you have all of these areas, and I think that's the way that you're getting all these points in order to beat us.
Do we have any criticisms of this game at all?
Oh, I mean, I have a few.
Okay, well, let's hear some.
I think the factory cards are often unbalanced or just a little bit random. Like, there are certain combinations or factions that have an easier run towards the center of the board than other ones do from the get-go.
We haven't actually talked about that mechanic yet.
Right. So anyway, in the center of the board is this area called the factory. And at the factory, there are mysterious technologies that you can unlock. And whenever your leader, and specifically your leader, and every time I teach this game, I have to tell everyone that it is only your leader that can play at the factory. No one else can go in there. Mechs just don't fit in the doors for whatever reason. But anyway, if your leader gets to the factory, you get to look at 1 plus the number of players playing the game hand of cards and pick whichever one you want. And it acts as a whole separate action space that only you have access to. And at the bottom of that space is always a double movement action for a single figure. And at the top is usually a very powerful way to either deploy one of your mechs, build a structure, do one of the big things in the game that you usually get set up for. And I find that once someone has, one or two players have gone there, I don't usually want to go there because by then I've done enough other things and the action cards have probably been pilfered enough that I'm not, I know the best ones are already gone from that pile. I go there because the territory is also worth 3 hexes at the end of the game. And that in and of itself is very worth it. But I think the factory cards can be a little bit swingy or, I don't know, just disincentivized later on in the game.
So taking a look at this game and comparing it to Kemet, and like I said, I think that for Scythe, engine building is much more important than it is in Kemet. You need to get some sort of engine going in Kemet, but Scythe is a little bit of a longer game, and it gives you that time in order to get the engine going.
And in Scythe, you can only win 2 stars by combat victories. It automatically doesn't let you win just by fighting all the time, unless you are the German, the black player, Saxony, I think is the one that can win multiple stars from combat. So.
I'm not positive.
I know it's black. I think black is Saxony, but I don't recall.
I think it is Saxony.
Anyway, ordinarily, you're limited to 2 combat star victories in this game. So Scythe is a game that says you can fight, but if your entire game is fighting, you're not doing the rest of the game. It's much more of a Cold War feel where you are in a standoff situation until you're ready to pounce for that star, and then you don't want to leave yourself hanging out there or overextended because really you just wanted to fight to win that star, claim that 1 hex or something that you critically needed, and then back away again.
Yeah, and Scythe, in a way, discourages going after someone else's area because if their meeple's there and you attack it, you're losing that popularity, and that is directly affecting your score. Because if you are dropping down to a lower bracket of popularity, it is a severe impact to your final score.
Scythe in combat in Scythe is also, it reminds me a little bit of Kemet because you have a power dial and each player can only spend so much power. I think it's 7 to bolster their combat. So you're limited right there from how much you can spend. And then for every plastic figure involved in the combat, you can possibly add another combat card to augment that strength a little bit. But it is sort of another card deterministic style combat where, you know, you set your power dial secretly determining how much of that 7 power you're allowed to spend. Obviously, you can only spend the power that you've generated and then possibly tuck another card in there as well. So it's that same moment of reveal. You had some information going into it, knowing what their powers could be. And you can pretty much only fight when you know you can win. You can math it out so that you're not going to lose a fight because you know how high the combat cards go to. You know how much power the opponent has. And theoretically, you can play games where you can fight and only win.
Yeah, and Scythe has that same kind of teleportation ability that Kemet does in a way. Because inside
the tunnels, there's
tunnels that will connect different boards or different spaces on the board. But Scythe overall is a much larger area than Kemet is. And with Scythe, it's always the same board. It doesn't get smaller if there's less players.
Right.
Which is always kind of interesting because all the players always start in the same place. The board is completely static, and that if you're the white player, you're going to start in this place. So there could be games where all 3 players are just right next to each other, or all 3 players are on complete opposite sides of the board.
The game balances that a little bit in that even once you learn to cross rivers, there you can only cross rivers into certain types of territories. So you can't just invade your neighbor's homeland. You have to be able to cross into whatever specific territory type they have. And usually there's only 1 point of entry off of each player's peninsula onto the mainland or onto an opponent's area. So it gets a bit clever with that. But yeah, lower player count, lower player number games have a very different feel to them than higher player count games. I like both. I really think, I've played 2-player games and I like 2-player games to Scythe. They're interesting because you just have space. I mean, you can spread out a bit. But boy, it becomes much more critical when you make your moves in those 2-player games.
I don't think I've ever actually played Scythe with fewer than 4.
You may not have.
Yeah. The other thing with Scythe and Kemet is that in Scythe, you know what your strategies are going to be because you know what all of your faction's abilities are, what their mechs are going to let you do, what everything is. In Kemet, you have a little bit more flexibility because all of those upgrades are available to you. Mm-hmm. You might just have your pyramids going towards one particular category of upgrade, but you can always kind of swing that around and find something else if someone starts. If you ever have something that you want to try to accomplish in Kemet, you can pivot and try to go that way.
Yeah, by the same token, Kemet's much more zero sum, where if one person is doing something, you're probably better off going in a completely different direction. It kind of reminds me of Blood Rage, actually, which isn't the game that I'm going to be mentioning as a specific example, but where you kind of want to figure out what everybody else is doing. Even though there isn't a drafting mechanic in Kemet specifically, you're still trying to find the path less traveled so that you can really sprint down that as quickly as you can go.
Sort of not related, but you've asked me earlier about criticism of the game, and I will say one of the things I find odd about this game, or just a little bit strange, is the end condition.
And this is Scythe, just to...
This is Scythe, okay. Yeah, sorry, we're on Scythe. I find the ending condition a little bit strange. Just the moment that a player places their 6-star, that's just it. In fact, and we have a little house rule that we play with, because I'm not super crazy about just that being it, and that's done, because ordinarily, I think I've seen it once. No, it's happened a couple of times, usually when players don't know, but when a player places that 6-star... You only do it if you're going to be in a position to win. I mean, and I don't like that, like, just sitting back right before you place your 6-star and being like, oh, can I win yet? Okay, no, then I'll wait a little bit. And then it has a weird feel to it. It feels kind of anticlimactic. Like, that's the only thing about this game that just doesn't quite click with me after I finish. I love the game. I love the action of playing the game. But the ending of the game just feels a little bit of a letdown. Like, you come back, like, count your things. Oh, you won. Well, of course, you placed your 6-star, like, I kind of thought you would win. Like, maybe there was a chance that someone else did better, but you wouldn't have placed your 6-star if this guy had all this territory over here and was in the top popularity tier.
Yeah.
So
yeah, it's kind of like shouting Uno, and then you're just trying to get rid of that one last card, kind of. Yeah.
Yeah, and Josh found a really good variant that the designer actually talked about on a forum, where the way we play all the time now is that when someone places that last star, it goes around the board one more time, except players can't move. So it lets you finish up other things.
Like, but housekeeping actions, basically, yeah, but not fighting.
Exactly. So you can't go after any other areas, but you can try to finish up for one last time some other star you were trying to place.
Right. I think it just, you know, there come times, because stars are also the other thing at the end of this game that are worth a ton of points. So placing 6 stars and being in the top popularity level, that's a lot of coins that are coming your way at the end of the game. And if one player was literally like, all they had to do was bolster to get into that top popularity bracket or that top power bracket, it's kind of like cheap that they couldn't have just bolstered. So we play with that variant. There is an expansion coming out that is called Airships or the Wind Gambit. It's going to add some different variable ending conditions. I'll be interested to see how those play out too, because like I said, the ending of this game is one of the only things that I find a little bit, okay, we're done.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how I feel it. I don't mind it, but it feels a bit strange.
Well, more Scythe and more 2 Scythe is always welcome in my mind.
Right. And I do like the expansion, too, that's out there, the Invaders from Afar, that has the 2 other factions. In fact, it feels... I like having 7 factions on the board. We've still never played with 7. One day it'll happen.
One day, and probably only one day.
Yeah.
All right. As always, we're going long, so let's go into other suggestions from the area control genre.
Boy, there's a couple of games that I'm thinking of, but I think I'm going to go with Memoir 44. So... Memoir 44 is a tight 2-player world war-based game, essentially. It's hexagonal control. It is much more dice-driven. It's very swingy. It's very luck-based. But if you take it with a grain of salt and say that that's just the odds of war, and what you have to do in that game is play the best to your hand that you're given, because you have command cards that sort of act on one of 3 different sectors on the board, and you can't always do what you want to do if you only have command cards for troops on the left sector and you're only going to be working on the right. But usually what that means is you shouldn't have started playing on the right without the command cards to back you up. So it's a two-player war game. The scenarios recreate historical battles, and they do it very, very well. And I encourage, if you play it, usually you play one player playing the Axis, one player playing the Allies, and then you switch and play the exact same scenario and take the best combined scores, because each scenario isn't weighted equally, because it's history, and that's how history works.
So there are a lot of games in this genre that I like. I thought about talking about Twilight Imperium. I thought about talking about Blood Rage. But there's this setting, this really, you know, it's kind of a niche, kind of an indie thing. I don't know how many people have heard of it, but it's called Star Wars. And there's this game called Star Wars Rebellion, where you are the Rebel Alliance and you're pitted against the Galactic Empire. What makes this game really exciting and memorable in my mind, and it also is probably really frustrating for some people, it's just how asymmetrical it is. As the rebels, you constantly feel like you're losing. As the empire, you constantly feel like you're winning. And at some point, you might lose as the empire and you might win as the rebels, but like you won't know until the last minute. And I love that about this game. What makes it interesting from an area control perspective is that in each area, rather than moving forces from the outside in, which is something that happens, but is something that kind of characterizes territory control in a lot of these other games, it's much more about building up influence from the inside out. And then you're supporting that with things like starships bringing in troops. But you're also just trying to, like, you're building insurrection. You know, as the Rebel Alliance, you are just not strong enough to go head-to-head and slog it out with these big ships. It's much more about, like, trying to sway the populace and maybe sabotage some stuff.
My suggestion is going to be Blood Rage, because Jameson did not suggest it.
Wait, you didn't say Small World?
Well, I came up with an idea for that. So we're going to have Matt's suggestion be Small World. So, I know.
Slick.
I know.
Fine. You get two suggestions, Aaron. That's cool.
No, we'll come back to Josh for a second suggestion.
It's your house. It's your rule.
We need four. We are a podcast based on the number four.
That's true.
Anyway, Blood Rage, it's awesome. It is another kind of hybridish game where you have area control, but a lot of other stuff going on. It's played over a series of ages. There's combat. It's a lot of fun. Go check it out if you haven't checked it out yet. And for Matt's suggestion,
does Matt even like Small World?
Matt likes Small World.
Okay.
Yeah, I've seen him play it a lot of times. Well, Matt loves Small World.
Sure.
Just always talking about it. But Small World from our favorite Days of Wonder. And in that game, it's great because each game you're randomizing races with special powers, and you're drafting, or not drafting, kind of buying races, and having civilizations go into decline, and then fighting each other for different area with a very, very clean and easy to grasp combat system. Mm-hmm. Check out Small World as well.
Maybe it's just my wargaming roots, but I just love this genre generally. I love Small World. I love Blood Rage. And there's a lot of different things to experience mm-hmm. in this genre. It's got a lot of options, and I just love it.
Yeah. So for our broader view today, we don't really have that good of a segue to going into it, but we wanted to talk a little bit about Ameritrash and Euro games. And when we were breaking this episode, Matt was like, well, which one of these games between Kemet and Scythe is the Ameritrash and which one is the Euro game? And that's kind of why we picked them, because neither one of them are that traditional Ameritrash or Euro game. So I think we should probably start off by talking a little bit about just quick definitions of what is a Euro game and what is Ameritrash.
Yeah, we can definitely do that. I think what we're finding more and more, though, to jump a little bit ahead, is that those definitions are breaking down in front of our eyes. And I think area control, we picked this topic because this was such a good representation where they have elements of both games, and these games are ones that do it exceptionally well. I think what is generally considered a Euro game is a more economic-focused game, a game where your actions are a little bit more programmed. There is notably less randomness. I think that's probably the big dividing point between the two genres of games is the random factor. Euro games tend to favor predictability, planning, development, and Ameritrash games tend to be thematically driven combat or dice-driven games that use randomness to facilitate replayability or depth of interaction, I suppose.
Yeah, I would say that's very key to each of those definitions. Euro game, deterministic. Look at mechanics more like worker placement, more like auctions. And with Ameritrash, you're looking at mechanics like card drafting and card combat and dice rolling, just to have those kind of more random events, but also traditionally with a lot more thematic elements. In both Scythe as well as Kemet, you kind of see the walls coming down a little bit and kind of seeing the best of both worlds being brought into that, because area control could be something that's very Ameritrashy with having a bunch of random cards and having dice roll. But in both of these games, there's a very deterministic quality about it. You're looking at, in Kemet, how many pieces are out there and having a very limited hand of cards that's identical. And it kind of takes away that traditional Ameritrashiness in order to come up with this more deterministic and more strategic game.
I know that at least some of our listeners aren't quite as into board games as we are. So let me just say this really quickly. Ameritrash is not a value judgment. It might have started that way back, you know, back when it was a bunch of people from, I don't know, Denmark making fun of us. But I certainly prefer games that are generally labeled Ameritrash.
What is the new, there's a new euphemism for Ameritrash. I think Ameritheme or thematic.
Dice Tower was trying to push Amerithrash for a while.
No, that's terrible.
That's terrible. Sorry, Dice Tower.
Shame on you, Dice Tower.
I've read something else that I was like, oh, that's a good one. But anyway,
Like, I mean, I've seen American style of game versus European style of game.
That's such a weird thing. That's like saying there are no...
Yeah, but there's... And what people might consider a Euro game is now being published in America.
So...
And what people would call a traditional Ameritrash game is being published in Europe.
Right. And historically, I think a lot of the Euro game model, especially that we're just coming off Spiel Essen Fallout right now, Europe does have a history of economic strategy board games that were taught as... lessons in school and a lot of hobby things. So there's definitely European roots to a lot of these games. I think that's why that title endures. I don't know where Ameritrash came from, just as a converse, but I mean, our games do tend to have a lot of toys in them, but I'd like to posit that miniatures and plastic figures don't make a game any less thinky. They just make it fun to play with.
Yeah, I don't disagree, but I'm not exactly. I mean, I'm we have previously talked about me commission painting your scythe figures. I am currently working on a Space Marine Intercessor as we record, so
if you ever hear the scraping in the background of the episodes, that is Jameson working on his commissions.
What do you think about Ameritrash versus Euro, Aaron? Do you think it still holds up? Do you think it's a valid comparison?
No. I've talked a lot about how much I love the Mind Clash games, which as of right now, there's still only two of them, Anachrony and Tricarion, and I think those are games that have very, very Euro mechanisms. There is very little that's up to chance, because even in Tricarion, there's an aspect where you can get cards, but they're all laid out, and anyone can buy whichever card they want. It's more of a worker placement and very much more deterministic, but it has deep theme, great art, which traditionally hasn't been part of Euro games. Euro games were... angry-looking men staring at a board blank cubes that you're pushing around on a board. And
I like pushing cubes, though.
And I do, too. Like, it has its place. I mean, I just talked about how much I love moving the little cubes inside.
Yep.
But I think the hobby's kind of moving away from that, and it's kind of taking the best of both worlds and putting it into every game that comes out.
I mean, I still like a more Euro-style game. I don't think the hobby is necessarily moving away from it. I think that the genres are becoming closer and closer because there are elements of each style of game that have their merits, and it's neat to see when they cross over and when they do different things. I think that's wonderful. I still think a solid mechanic in a game, though, is going to win me over. If there is a game that has something very clever mechanically going on, often the only thing that differentiates one Euro game from another Euro game is just a slight variant on a mechanic, but wow, can make a huge difference. I think that's one of the things I like most about them.
So I can think of a lot of pretty new Euro games. What's an example of a contemporary game that's unambiguously Ameritrash? Like, is it possible that Ameritrash is just being, you know, at least started out as being used as a way to condescendingly say doesn't have Euro mechanics?
No. Or
Zombicide, Ameritrash Quest, game?
Yep.
Blood, or not Blood Rage, but the others, pretty much any big CMON production
Certainly
is going to be just a Ameritrash dice fest.
So there's still, so that's still a pretty big category. Like there is a pure, there are a lot of games out there that are just that way. What about like the others? Would that be Ameritrash?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Plus there's a whole category of like dexterity games, party games. Those are all usually lumped into the Ameritrash category as well.
Wait, what about monikers?
That'd be that's a party game. Yeah. That'd be.
Yeah. Oh. Okay. Yeah. I definitely prefer Ameritrash.
And the other thing that I kind of, and this might just be me, what I associate with a classic Euro game is a shorter play time. Like going back to some of the older ones, they played a lot quicker. But I think that's kind of something that they've moved away from. And now you're getting Euro games that are allowing you more time to build up these bigger strategies and get a lot deeper. An example off the top of my head would be the Gallerist that I just got not that long ago that is, in my mind, a true Euro game with a lot of action selection and just classic Euro mechanics, but it is definitely not a short game.
No. I think another thing I notice in Euro games are that people that are really into Euro games follow designers. They know the history of their designers, and designers that work in a European game format seem like that's what they do best, and they really enjoy working there. So they like tweaking with their models, putting a variation, putting a new spin on something else. And people that follow their games really respond to that. Uwe Rosenberg is one that comes to the top of my mind. All his games artistically look very similar. I find that they play very similarly. He has trademarks that he seems to put in almost every game. And people that like his games flock to the next game. They get really, really excited just to see what he's come up with next for their brains to puzzle out in a certain way. I think that's one thing I noticed in the Eurogame category that isn't quite as present in the Ameritrash category.
Yeah, the only person that's like jumping out at my head is Eric Lang
right.
for all of his right. wonderful Ameritrash games that I hope he keeps making forever.
Mm-hmm. And what would one of those be?
Again, that's our Blood Rage,
Arcadia Quest,
the other. Basically,
are those all him?
Yeah, those are all,
they're all him.
Yeah. You're a big fan of Eric Lang without even knowing it, Jameson.
Yeah, that's true.
He has Rising Sun coming out, too, that I'm excited for.
Yeah. I think that we're getting really close to that hour mark. So does anyone have anything else they want to say about the whole Ameritrash Eurogame dichotomy?
Forget it. Play what you like. Play it all. They're all great. There's stuff you can enjoy in every category of game, depending on who you're playing with and what kind of mood you're in. I never would limit myself as one type of gamer. That's just silly.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing about this discussion is that the labels aren't really applying anymore. Things are taking from both categories. And that's great because that means that we are learning from each other, sharing ideas, and using them to come up with the best games possible.
I don't know. Well, as somebody who's kind of just newer to the hobby generally and certainly doesn't spend as much time in that headspace, it's kind of helpful for me to have this conversation too, because I'm recognizing distinctions now that you point them out. But this is honestly, like, I didn't really know what those definitions were before, so thank you guys.
Yeah,
you're very welcome, Jameson. All right, so check us out in 2 weeks, where our category is going to be family games, and we're going to be talking about Ticket to Ride as well as Forbidden Island. We're going to do a broad review discussion about bringing games home for the holidays to play with your family. Our music was generously provided by Delicious Pastries, a local Pittsburgh band. Please email the podcast at menonboardpodcast@gmail.com. Find us on Facebook and Instagram at menonboardpodcast. Find us on Twitter at menonboardpod. We have a guild over on BoardGameGeek. Our website is menonboardpodcast.com. Thank you guys for listening.
Thanks, guys. Good night.
Good night. I'm just going to take my phone out. It will be off, but that way I can see if it like lights up with I'm having a baby.
Oh, my God.
Right. I mean, that's legit. Like, you can have your phone out.
That'll definitely be the end of episode clip.
Yeah,
that'll be
we have to go. Jameson's wife having is in labor. This is why you don't hang out with straight people.
We'll finish the episode first.
No, I will drag it.
Also, that's very heteronormative of you.
That's true. Well, it's
queer people can have babies too.
Still pretty rare that homosexual males give birth very often. I've heard it's happened, but it's pretty rare.
It's more difficult, certainly.